At this time, we'll invite our panel members to come up. And you notice we have five chairs, or yes. And we only had three speakers from back in Andrews. I'd like to invite Karen Jensen. Karen, where are you? Here we are, Karen. PhD in biology. She's the curator of the museum, I think, at Leona Meadows. Is that right? And Dr. Robert Brown, are you still here? Yeah, right here. Good. Super. Who is the director of the Geoscience Research Institute. And we're glad to have you join our panel up here and maybe help in our question and answers. I'm going to ask those that would like to ask questions to come up to the front so we don't spend time in translation and going through it again. If you have a question, I'd like you to come up here and please just one question at a time and address it to a particular individual or to the panel in general if you'd like to.
My question is, has anybody checked the tree rings on those so-called 70 layers of forest there in Petrified Forest? Dendrochronology, you know, the age of tree rings, compared them. Yeah, you were talking about 70 layers of trees there in Yellowstone. If they all came at the same time, they ought to have the same tree ring pattern. I just wondered if anybody has checked that.
Yes.
Can we have that lapel mic on too, please?
Yes, that's a good question, and it has been investigated. At Loma Linda University, several people have done research on the tree rings at Yellowstone. There's a man from Japan, Tetsuya Yamamoto, that looked at each one and identified the kinds of trees and did find, as he had mentioned, that there were different trees in different layers, and often the trees in the layer did not match the leaves in the sediment beneath them, fossil leaves there. An interesting sidelight on that is that at Spirit Lake, of course there's dust settling down in there making these little organic layers, not a soil layer, but you know it would be called that in the fossil, I guess. And the different trees broke up and sank at different times. The cedar trees broke up and were never floating very much because they were too brittle. And I think it's Douglas fir, isn't it, that's still floating, but for a few years. And they're still floating now. It's 15 years later and they're still floating. But some of the other trees would be found at the bottom of the lake now that are not floating. And anyway, the most interesting thing is Dr. Michael Arkt looked at thin sections of the fossil tree rings, and he learned to read them. You know, you have big cells in the springwood and small in the as the season goes on, and he found, you know, if you find patterns. Just like there could be signatures, they called it, with the trace elements, they're signatures of tree ring patterns. And if you found several trees that had the same signature, then it's pretty likely that they lived at the same time in the same place. And so the question would be, would you find them in all the ones with a good signature matching, would they be all in one layer, and then there'd be different signature and different meaning different forests, successive forests, or might you find the same signature in different layers, which might be if the trees had floated in and then certain ones came down and maybe another one came down later, it might be in a different layer. He found this signature in different layers. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so there's a lot more to say about that, but that's basically it. It's a good question.
Quite a number of years after the flood, Genesis records that in the days of Peleg, the earth was divided. Would any of you care to comment on the event that describes and its relationship, if any, to the flood?
Days of Peleg, division. Go ahead.
Okay, Genesis 10:25. Genesis 10:25 mentions that, but does it mean the earth in the sense of the geology, like the continents moving? We believe that the continents may have moved very much, and they would still be moving then, but also it has to do with the people. And you guys, come on, talk about
it seems more likely to me that it's referring to the time in which the Tower of Babel occurred and the dividing up of the languages and the dividing up of the different peoples. Although the other isn't ruled out completely, but it would
contextually
it would seem to favor that.
But if at the time of Peleg, many years after the flood, there was something where the earth was divided in a violent way, it would be like having the flood all over again. I don't think so.
This for Dr. Yonkers. This has to do with archaeology, Egyptian. Are you familiar with a David Roll that was out of England, and he maintained that there was two of the Egyptian dynasties were concurrent, and that makes the Bible match up with history. Are you familiar with that theory?
Are you talking possibly about Dr. Coraville from Loma Linda, or what was the name of
this? Was a man from England, Rohl or Rouhl, and he ran amok of all the other archaeologists. They were in a big fight with him. He was on the television.
I'm not familiar with his particular arguments. There have been a number of people, including Emmanuel Velikovsky and in the Adventist Church, Donovan Coraville, thank you, who tried to reconstruct all of Egyptian history to make it conform more with the biblical chronology. That's a very intriguing idea. It's a complex, you know, issue, actually. There is some evidence, for example, during the period between the 12th dynasty and the 18th dynasty, there was a period of confusion, and there is evidence that at times Egyptian dynasties did overlap. During the Hyksos period, there were several dynasties running simultaneously. However, the short answer is that there really is not the contraction of time, and you can't overlap some of the dynasties that Dr. Coraville and Dr. Manuel Velikovsky want to contract. It doesn't work. The reason is kind of complex, but they would try and correlate different people, you know, that would be separated in history by 600 years or so, and suggest they're the same person. When you look at those suggested identifications, they don't really work on linguistic grounds as well as Dr. Coraville and Dr. Velikovsky suggested. There are also stratigraphic problems with that. Again, that's a very technical issue, but we can be quite certain that these were different people, not the same people, and they were indeed separated archaeologically by a period of time, because we can find the seals of these different people separated stratigraphically. So it seems like Egyptian history on the whole is relatively fairly accurate. That's not to say it couldn't be contracted a little bit. I think it can, and there are some dynasties that overlap, but not to the extent that these individuals suggest.
I see. If I could interject one thing, Professor Harold Clark was my wife's uncle through marriage, and I spent many Sabbath afternoon talking to him, and on this dividing of the earth, he thought that they had to do something with map making
with continental drift maybe, or something like that, you mean? Or
surveying, you know, laying
out. Cartography, I see. Okay, yeah.
My question is a theological one, and it popped into my head last night as Dr. Baldwin was speaking. You gave reference to the bombardier beetle and also to the immune system as evidence of creation. How could these systems come about unless they had been created? My question is, why would God need to create such systems? Why would God, in a perfect world, have to create defense against a predator, be it a frog or be it a virus or a bacteria, and any of the theologists could.
Thank you. That's an excellent question, and one we really have not really talked to in this conference, and that has to do with the whole question of evil and the entrance of sin, and why would God need to produce these kinds of things in a perfect world? In other words, in the Garden of Eden, were there tigers that went up and preyed on gazelles and so forth? And maybe just to address a few remarks, but it's an excellent question. And it seems to me that the Bible, when it speaks about the curses, there were three divine curses on the earth. Seemed for me to help me to understand this a little bit better. When God spoke to the serpent, I believe with a tearful heart, on your belly you shall go. In other words, implying that he hadn't gone on his belly before. So perhaps a different kind of transportation. Now, was this kind of like a reversal of creation? When God spoke, there were things that happened in the 6 days. And when God says, cursed art thou above all cattle, I need to have our biblical Old Testament theologians give us whether or not that might be suggesting a tip of the iceberg or whatever. Could that be that God is allowing something maybe he has either pre-programmed in or starting right there, which would immediately begin to adjust nature to the sin problem and to allow these things to come? I think it happened very rapidly. And God said, I don't want you to touch that tree because then you will know the knowledge of evil, good and evil. To me, it's a wonderful thing that God theologically describes our current order as a cursed order. Oh, I think that's marvelous. And in Revelation, the curses, we're going to have no more tears, no more crying, and no more death, but also no more curses. He's going to reverse that, those curses.
Could I just say something about that? The differences that happened when you study, like God mentioned in Genesis 3:18 about thorns and thistles.
Yes, yes.
Did he have to make a new creation to have thorns and thistles? No. When you study thorns and other prickles, it's like, well, on thistles, it's like taking a green leaf that could have been productive, and instead of having it large, it's cut in. So the leaf veins are sticking out as prickles. It's less productive than it would have been. And other kinds of thorns are like from a little branch bud that could have grown and leafed and flowered and fruited and been a fruitful bough, but instead it aborts and sclerifies as a little thorn. In other words, it's a distortion or a degeneration of what was there before. Parasites are known to be degenerate things. And so the curse is basically a withdrawal of part of the blessing that would enable a thing to do its full potential. And there's all kinds of parables in that. Some lives are kind of thorny. They need to unfold. And so that's what's happening here. And he mentioned, the fellow who asked mentioned the immune system. That's been a question. Why should God even create an immune system? You know what they found in recent years? The immune system, what we call the immune system, is only part of a beautiful equilibrium system in the body where it keeps the chemistry in balance. And it's a very comprehensive system. But our world is so full of germs that the reaction to foreign proteins and stuff has gotten so big that it eclipses the beautiful, beautiful equilibrium system. And so all we see is this immune thing, and we say, well, why should God design that? Well, it's good that he did, and it's in there, but it's only part of what he designed. And we shall see the beauty of the rest of it when things are restored.
Beautiful.
Dr. Yonker, what archaeology activity is Andrews University doing now or planning to do in the Middle East?
Right now, as I was saying in my introduction, we are involved with this Matawa Plains project, which is simultaneously excavating these three cities in the region. We believe it might be the region of Reuben, actually. Some new evidence, I didn't talk about this earlier, has come up that we are actually working in the area where the tribe of Reuben first settled down. And we're quite excited about those discoveries. Again, it would take too long to get into that. But this project will go on for the foreseeable future. At the same time, one of my colleagues from the Institute at Andrews, Dr. Stanla Bianca, is working with the new Palestinian Authority. As the Israelis have been slowly turning over territory and some control over to the Palestinians, that's a very contentious issue, as you know from listening to the news. The Palestinians are starting to have, you know, control over their own land, and one of the things they want to do is develop their own Department of Antiquities. The Jordanians have it, the Israelis have one, and the Palestinians, that's part of being, you know, a self-determining people, is to have your own government, including a Department of Antiquities. One of the things the Palestinians hope to do to be a free country is to encourage a source of income, such as tourism. That's one of the ways Israel makes money, is all the tourists that come. And one of the ways, of course, of encouraging tourism is to excavate archaeological sites. The very area that the Palestinians control is the heartland of biblical Israel. Sites like Shechem and Bethel and Gibeon and Gibeah and Jericho, all these famous sites are within their territory. So Dr. LaBianca has contacted them, and they are very interested. Of all the American universities that have worked in the Middle East, because Andrews University has worked with Arab peoples like the Jordanians for the last 30 years, they're very open to working with us because we have a good track record working with the Arab world. So they have told us they would like us to come and train their new archaeologists. They're getting a new department going. They want our people to come. In fact, this summer, we're going to be spending time meeting with the leaders of their new department, training their teachers, training their students. And there may be future plans. We're already having some preliminary talks of maybe excavating in the future sites like Shechem or Jericho, or doing survey work in those areas. We don't know where the Lord's going to lead, but if peace can come to the area, there's some very exciting possibilities. So we're right now in the process of seeing what Andrews University will be doing in archaeology in the future. The
Lord works in marvelous ways, doesn't he?
The date of the Exodus, are we agreed on this, and do other scholars agree with us on the date?
We are not agreed on this, I suppose, would be the quick question. Most Adventists traditionally, and I happen to be one who holds this position, we follow the biblical chronological data fairly closely. And that means that we use 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 1, as a pretty serious starting point for trying to reconstruct the chronology back to the time of the Exodus. 1 Kings 6:1 says that it was from the fourth year of the reign of King Solomon. It was 480 years back to the time of the Exodus. It says the very day, the very month, the very year. So that to me seems to be a pretty firm starting point. We happen to know that the fourth year of King Solomon was probably pretty close to 966 B.C. One Adventist scholar, Dr. Shea, suggests 970 B.C. because of a co-regency between David and Solomon. We won't bore you with the details, but in short, we're quite certain, if you take the Bible seriously, that the Exodus must have occurred somewhere between 1450 and 1445 B.C. Now, there is a group of scholars, not for biblical reasons so much, who suggest maybe the Exodus occurred later in the 13th century, somewhere around maybe 1280 B.C. But their reasons are not so much biblical as they are philosophical and archaeological, and it's very questionable whether the evidence there is very good or not. Finally, there is out in the world outside of Adventism the consensus view among archaeologists. Most of them are pretty anti-biblical. They don't believe the Bible is the inspired word of God. They see it rather as purely a human document with unreliable information that has to be tested all the time, and they tend to view it skeptically and unreliable. Those scholars, the majority of them, don't believe there ever was an Exodus. That's the current thinking. They think that's basically a made-up story. They don't think Israel came from Egypt. Rather, they think that the Israelites evolved in a slow social evolutionary process in the land, that there were a bunch of Canaanites who revolted against their overlords and evolved into the Israelites. This is quite a contrary picture to what's described in the Bible. But generally, Adventist scholars stick closer to what the text says. And there's even a group of scholars outside there that say, you know, the best starting point is to take the text at face value and start there first. So we tend to be at that school of thought. So I would think that most Adventist scholars would probably stick with a 1445, 1450 B.C. Exodus date.
I'd just like to add a point on that for your further resource if you'd like to study further. Dr. Bill Shea, who is at the Biblical Research Institute, was asked to write the article on the date of the Exodus for the prestigious new International Standard Bible Encyclopedia. And so if you just look up Exodus, date of, he compares the 15th century versus the 13th century. He shows a number of fantastic correlations between the 18th dynasty of Pharaoh's time with what happened at the Exodus. Just one sample of that is Thutmose III. We have in his tomb biography his exact date of his death, March 17, 1450. And if you go with Shea's chronology, a pharaoh died in the spring of 1450. And you go and you look at the mummy of Thutmose III, and they've been able to x-ray this mummy to determine how old the mummy is, and it's not the right mummy. It should be in the 60s, and it's a much younger mummy. They lost the body of the real Thutmose III. Where did he go? Probably drowned in the Red Sea.
Man.
And we could go on and on. And he gathers this evidence. It reads like a mystery thriller, but it's true history. So the book is the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia. It's available in most libraries. ISBE. Volume 1, Exodus, date of the Exodus.
Before we take maybe our last couple of questions, somebody has lost a purse. It's kind of a black purse, has car keys in it. They're very important. If anybody finds one sitting around or near one somewhere that you don't know who it belongs to, we'd appreciate having that brought to our attention. Thank you. Okay, we have another question.
On the column of the different life forms are buried in the sediment, you have the smaller going up to the larger, to the dinosaurs, the shelf underneath. How did they get buried in this level? I mean, you know, with one on top of the other, with a, you know, smaller creatures on the bottom and then the dinosaurs up above and so forth.
Maybe Robert Brown. Yeah, maybe Dr. Brown. We could all take a stab, but I think Dr. Brown might be the best one to speak to it.
The answer to that question is that I don't know. But I would suggest that if you start with burying the material that was torn loose by the flood, the lowest stuff would be buried would be the organisms that live on the seafloor. These are small organisms, generally. And then as we go higher and higher, the larger organisms would be able to survive turbid waters, or if they're outside the water, climb to higher levels. So as we go into through a sequence of deposits from the very beginning, the first stuff would be buried in calm basins in the flood area. And then we'd get higher and higher. And finally, the very largest animals, the ones most capable of staying above the turbulence, would be the last ones buried. These are the dinosaurs and the Cretaceous. This makes sense to me. Now, I don't know how it happened, but if it happened according to normal physical processes, or I understand them, it would come out that way, regardless of any particular person's worry about it. So the big ones, the dinosaurs, should be on top, where we do find them, and the small marine organisms should be down at the bottom, where we find them. I don't see it as any evidence of evolution whatsoever, but merely the natural operation of physical processes in a worldwide catastrophe that gradually had higher and higher waters.
Do any of the rest of you have anything to add to that, or is that kind of our standard answer, if that's the right standard at this time? And
One thing I'd like to add is that when you look at the order in the fossil record, you know, those nice layers, you can see them in the Grand Canyon, you can see them all over the world, that he doeth all things well, decently and in order, even the flood. And you remember Dr. Davidson last night mentioned how when you go up a mountain, you go through different life zones. You see the shrubs, and then you might see the oak woodland, and then the Jeffrey pines, and then the fir trees, and then timber line. And the pre-flood world probably wasn't that much relief, but as the waters went up, they would get different life zones. And also there might be different areas in the world. And so it's a long way from figuring out what's in the layers and then understanding what the pre-flood world was from that. But it is orderly, and it's a wonderful thing to be studying. And ecological zonation is part of it, I think. And also, of course, motility, like he mentioned, the ones that could go up higher, and also flotation after they died. They get moved by the currents, and log jams of dinosaur bodies is what you see at Dinosaur National Monument. And there's a lot of factors operating. It's very complex, but I think I'm looking forward to the end when we see a movie of the whole thing and see how it works.
If I could. We have here a specialist. Robert Brown is a specialist in wrestling with the radiometric dating, the time clocks. And no, I don't think anyone has asked carbon about that, and the carbon dating and so forth. And I know he can give us the three-hour answer, but I really think we should take advantage of his expertise to just get a little taste of some possible, plausible explanations for that.
That's a good question. Before we take that question, I want to say we have enough questions up here to keep us going right now, so we won't take more after this. What we do have here.
Well, the last one would keep us for a whole weekend. You do not determine the dates of interment in any cemetery by doing radioisotope analysis of the soil or the rocks or the headstones. We go to records in the county office where there are burial records, or we read the records that are carved on the headstones of when certain burials took place, not any radioisotope dating. I think we should use the same approach regarding the dating of material that is buried in the past, particularly in the flood. See, we don't call it Noah today. What do we call it?
God's flood.
God's flood.
Amen.
That's it.
Thank you.
For the scientific community dates the burial of these fossils by doing radioisotope analysis.